6,249. Active, 1,827. Midland County, 6,405 confirmed, 112 deaths. From the Texas Tribune, average new cases increased by 1,126 cases compared with the 7-day average a week ago. On November 14th, 8,989 new cases were reported. Hospitalizations increased by 1,083 patients compared with a week ago. As of November 14th, 7,151 Texans are hospitalized for the coronavirus. Average new deaths increased by 13 deaths compared with the 7-day average a week ago. On November 14th, 150 new deaths were reported. West Texas Intermediate trading at $41.30, and that is up $1.17. All of the markets are very happy this morning because of the news. First, we'll look at a couple of coronavirus briefs, and then we'll go into the more of the story about the new vaccine announcement today. The total number of U.S. coronavirus cases reported to date surpassed 11 million on Sunday, only 1 week after hitting the 10 million mark. The number of fatalities from the virus now stands at more than 245,000. More than 1 million U.S. children have been diagnosed with COVID-19, pediatricians say. But a glimmer of hope emerged Monday when biotechnology company Moderna said its experimental coronavirus vaccine is nearly 95% effective, according to initial results. The National Institutes of Health is co-developing the vaccine candidate. Moderna's announcement, after Pfizer and its German partner BioNTech said last week that their experimental vaccine is more than 90% effective at preventing the virus, raises the possibility that two vaccines could become available in the United States in the months to come. U.S. stock futures jumped Monday as Moderna's news left investors hopeful that the country might have two coronavirus vaccines available on a limited basis by the end of 2020. Vaccines and test events make the IOC very confident Japan's Olympics next summer will go ahead with fans. And that will be very nice news as a welcome distraction next summer. Now, let's get into the vaccine itself. And for that, we're going to go to a pre-recorded report this morning from NPR. Moderna's COVID-19 vaccine shines in clinical trial.
I'm Steve Inskeep with news of a second coronavirus vaccine. We started last week with Pfizer's assertion that early testing showed its vaccine is 90% effective. A new week, new vaccine. Today, the biotech company Moderna says its experimental vaccine is nearly 95% effective. NPR's Joe Palca is with us to evaluate this. Hi there, Joe.
Morning, Steve.
Is that as good as it sounds?
Yeah, I think so. It's very good, especially considering the Food and Drug Administration was prepared to consider green-lighting a vaccine with only 50% efficacy. Mm. So scientists who've seen these results so far are impressed.
How did Moderna determine that it works so well?
Well, it was a big study of 30,000 volunteers. They came from a variety of ethnic backgrounds, 6,000 self-identified as Latinx or Hispanic, 3,000 self-identified as Black or African-American. Mm-hmm. Half got two injections of the vaccine, half got two injections of an inert placebo. And in order to see if the vaccine works, you have to wait until people get exposed to the virus. Moderna chief medical officer Tal Zaks says that wasn't a problem.
Unfortunately, cases are occurring at high rates in this country, and the paradox of that is that it enables rapid vaccine development because you're able to quickly demonstrate whether the vaccine works or not, and as we've shown today, ours certainly seems to work very well.
So there were a total of 95 people who got sick, 90 were in the placebo group, compared with only 5 in the vaccinated group, so the vaccine appeared to be working, and it didn't seem to cause any serious side effects.
Disturbing at the same time that it's hopeful that we have the right environment for testing a vaccine for
reason.
Now, Pfizer, we mentioned, had this vaccine that needs to be stored in ultra-cold freezers, which raised questions about how you practically get that across the country. Is Moderna's vaccine any better in that respect?
Yes, it seems to be. I mean, they've done some testing, and they also put out a release today saying that their vaccine was stable for 30 days at what you would consider a normal refrigerator freezer temperature, about well, it's about minus 20 centigrade or minus 4 Fahrenheit. And it also stayed stable for 6 months at that temperature and 30 days at normal refrigerator temperatures. So that makes life a lot easier.
Well, what comes next then?
Well, what comes next is in the next few weeks, the company will consider applying for what's called an EUA, an emergency use authorization. And that means that under the circumstances, because we're in a pandemic emergency, they can go ahead and give the vaccine out more widely. They have to wait a little longer to get safety data. They're waiting to see if the vaccine actually causes any problems itself, and they want to wait at least 2 months until half the volunteers have completed their full vaccine dosage. So it's still a couple days for that to happen, and then a couple days for this, or a couple weeks maybe, to get this application together to the Food and Drug Administration, and then the FDA has to go ahead and make its decision about whether to give some sort of authorization, this emergency use authorization.
Yeah, this process that can take years is being crunched down to weeks, months, even days, but I guess the FDA still has the basic questions. Is it safe? Is it effective?
Right. And the thing is, people have said, well, are we cutting corners or rushing this to the market? And the answer seems to be no, because it's just the process, which is normally I'll get back to you sometime, has been shortened to be let's do this right away and as fast as we can.
NPR's Joe Palca, thanks.
You're welcome.
Before we move on to other topics, I'm going to read two short follow-up articles that's related to the vaccine announcement this morning. Moderna's vaccine has a significant advantage over Pfizer's, by CNN's Elizabeth Cohen. Moderna announced this morning that its coronavirus vaccine is 94.5% effective against the virus, making it the second vaccine in the United States to have a stunningly high success rate. Last week, Pfizer announced that early data show its vaccine is more than 90% effective against the disease. While the two vaccines appear to have very similar safety and efficacy profiles, Moderna's vaccine has a significant practical advantage over Pfizer's. Pfizer's vaccine has to be kept at minus 75 degrees Celsius, or about minus 103 degrees Fahrenheit. No other vaccine in the U.S. needs to be kept that cold, and doctors' offices and pharmacies do not have freezers that go that low. Moderna's vaccine can be kept at minus 20 degrees Celsius, which is about minus 68 degrees Fahrenheit. Other vaccines, such as the one against chickenpox, need to be kept at that same temperature. And that means that Moderna's vaccine can be kept in a readily available freezer that is available in most doctors' offices and pharmacies, said Dr. Tal Sachs, Moderna's chief medical officer. We leverage infrastructure that already exists for other marketed vaccines. Another advantage of Moderna's vaccine is that it can be kept for 30 days in the refrigerator, the company announced Monday. And Pfizer's vaccine can last only 5 days in the refrigerator. Now here's a short article about another vaccine. Johnson & Johnson starts new two-dose COVID vaccine trial in Britain, from CNN Health's Maggie Fox. Johnson & Johnson's vaccine arm, Janssen Pharmaceuticals, is starting a new advanced Phase 3 trial of its experimental coronavirus vaccine in Britain, which uses two doses instead of just one, to see if that protects people better against infection. Most of the coronavirus vaccines and late-stage clinical trials around the world require two doses for full protection, including leading candidates developed by Pfizer, Moderna, AstraZeneca, and Novavax. Janssen's was the lone single-dose vaccine in Phase 3 trials in the U.S. and Britain. They realized now that two doses gives you slightly better immunity. Kate Bingham, a biotechnology expert who is the head of the UK Vaccine Task Force, told reporters in a briefing. Where will the trial be rolled out? Up to 30,000 people will be enrolled in the new global trial, with participants in Belgium, Colombia, France, Germany, the Philippines, South Africa, Spain, the United Kingdom, and the United States, the company said in a statement. In order to evaluate the efficacy of Janssen's COVID-19 vaccine candidate, clinical trial sites in countries and areas with high incidence of COVID-19 and the ability to achieve a rapid initiation were selected. Two doses. Volunteers will get two shots, 57 days apart, or placebos. The first volunteer was scheduled to be vaccinated in Britain today. While a potentially effective single-dose preventative COVID-19 vaccine with a good safety profile would have significant benefits, particularly in a pandemic setting, Janssen's COVID-19 vaccine program has been designed to be extremely thorough and driven by science. As such, we are investigating multiple doses and dosing regimens to evaluate their long-term efficacy, the company said. Janssen's Phase 3 trial paused for 2 weeks in the U.S. over safety concerns, but resumed in October. Now we turn our attention closer to home, and that is El Paso. I have three pre-recorded reports, the first from the Texas Standard today. El Paso sags amid coronavirus surge, averaging more than 1,000 new cases per day. Following is a report from NPR. Shutdown order causes kerfluffle in El Paso. And then the third is, as COVID-19 cases soar, El Paso Convention Center becomes hospital.
Alas, it has been a grim past several weeks in El Paso. There, the number of people hospitalized for coronavirus has grown nearly 10 times what it was at the start of September. The Department of Defense has sent in medical teams, and local funeral homes have prepared additional refrigerated storage space. And now, as the Texas Tribune reports today, the city morgue is so overwhelmed that inmates from the county's detention facility are being brought in to help with the overflow of bodies. The Tribune reports the arrangement is temporary as officials await help from the National Guard. As Texas became the first state in the U.S. to report more than 1 million COVID-19 cases, with numbers climbing statewide, it's apparent no major city in the Lone Star State has been hit quite as hard as El Paso, now averaging more than 1,000 new cases per day. So many people are sick, in fact, the city's convention center has been converted into a field hospital. KERA's Mallory Falk reports on how local businesses and health officials are trying to manage the COVID surge.
Funeral home manager Jorge Ortiz wheels a body to his chapel, but not for a funeral service. The chapel's been converted into a storage cooler. Ortiz runs Purchase Funeral Homes. So many bodies have come in, he had to create extra space.
The last 2 weeks, we have received more COVID cases than the past, months. I mean, when we hit the peak back in maybe the summer, but that's nothing compared to what we're living right now.
His team is trying to manage this constant flow and comfort so many families who've lost loved ones to the virus.
They just took them to emergency. They left them there, and next time they saw them was 2 weeks later when they passed away. But they saw them in a coffin. They saw them in the funeral home.
More than 700 El Pasoans have officially died due to COVID complications, though the number is likely much higher, with hundreds of deaths still under investigation. County officials brought in 4 mobile morgues, but that wasn't enough. They added 6 more. As coronavirus numbers climb, state and local leaders have fought over how to respond. El Paso's top county official ordered a temporary shutdown of non-essential businesses. The state attorney general challenged that order, calling it unnecessary and illegal. A court then blocked the order and a countywide curfew. And El Paso's mayor has encouraged businesses to stay open. While leaders clash, some healthcare workers are still calling for a shutdown.
Claro que también pensamos en los negocios.
Nurse Ariana Lucio spoke at a bilingual press conference on Friday.
Pero, ¿qué negocio va a haber si no hay gente, si todos estamos muriéndonos?
Of course, we also think about businesses, she said. But what business will there be if there's no people, if we're all dying? Hospitals are stretched thin. Dozens of ICU patients have been airlifted to other cities in Texas. The state and federal governments sent in extra healthcare workers and more medical supplies.
So within El Paso, we've probably created almost 600 new beds.
Joel Hendricks is chief medical officer at University Medical Center, one of the region's largest. He estimates more than 60% of patients at his hospital are there because of COVID. For now, they've been able to expand, like setting up medical tents in a parking lot, because of the resources the state sent to El Paso. but he's worried what happens when other communities see a spike in infections.
That's why we think it's very important for El Paso to start blunting this curve and decreasing the amount of infections that are being transmitted. If we can do that, then they won't end up in our hospital because they won't need that care. So yes, we are concerned, and certainly we haven't even gotten to flu season yet, which will affect all the nation, and in particular Texas, where most of our resources are coming from.
Some state resources are now going to Lubbock, just the latest hotspot in Texas. I'm Mallory Falk in El Paso.
It's been an especially bad week in Texas. The state passed the grim coronavirus milestone of 1 million confirmed cases. And the situation is particularly bad in El Paso. Hospitals there are overwhelmed. They've brought in mobile morgues to handle the high number of deaths. To try to control the outbreak, El Paso County ordered all non-essential businesses to shut down, but a court has put that plan on hold. Angela Cocherga of member station KTEP joins us from El Paso. Hi there.
Hi, Ari.
What's the story behind this back and forth about whether businesses must close?
Well, all you have to do is look at the numbers. It's really bad here in Texas in general, but El Paso in particular is being called the current epicenter of Texas's soaring coronavirus problems. So the top elected official here decided that requiring all non-essential businesses to close would be the safest plan of action to slow the spread. He also put in place an overnight curfew. But all of these things were challenged by some local restaurant owners, and then the Texas Attorney General joined in, basically arguing that only the governor has the power to order a shutdown. One judge agreed with the shutdown, and then an appeals court yesterday said that was wrong and put the shutdown and the curfew on hold.
Now, Texas has the most cases of any state in the U.S. right now, as you mentioned. How does the uniqueness of El Paso as a city contribute to the situation that we're seeing today?
Well, this is really a place where there is politics in play. The governor is a Republican, and El Paso is largely Democratic, and there's a lot of pressure from businesses large and small to stay open. The mayor here in El Paso, also a Republican, said he's very concerned about their livelihoods and that if they shut down, they won't be able to reopen at all. And El Paso's county judge, the top official here, is a Democrat. And, of course, we've also got Juarez just across the Mexican border. And so there has been this back and forth with the county judge and the mayor not seeing eye to eye on these restrictions. Now, the governor says he's in charge of emergency orders, and it's really not up to local officials to have a say at all, which is why there are literally dozens of cities and counties across Texas paying attention to this legal fight.
And this burden is falling on hospitals in El Paso. I understand a group of local nurses spoke out today about the conditions that they're dealing with. What did they say?
Well, they painted a really bleak picture. There's a shortage of medical staff, but also not enough PPE, personal protective equipment, like masks. They also talked about being on the verge of rationing care, and they're just physically and emotionally drained just from the sheer human tragedy of it all. Idali Cooper usually works in a critical care pediatric unit, but she's now one of the nurses on COVID duty. And she says she's frustrated some elected officials like the governor and judges are stopping El Paso from putting the shutdown and curfew into place.
I welcome them to come and work with us and go through what we go through every single day, when we have to take care of COVID-positive patients, and we see that they can't breathe. they're in desperation.
And of course, with the holidays coming up, I'm sure officials are even more concerned that things might get worse.
They're very worried, Ari. This is a place where people have large family gatherings, large extended families, and multi-generational gatherings. So there's a real concern on the part of health officials that people who don't live in the same household will be getting together, and they know what that will lead to. Another spike in coronavirus cases and even more deaths.
That's Angela Kocherga of member station KTEP in El Paso, Texas. Thank you for your reporting.
Thank you, Ari.
Texas recently became the first state in the U.S. to reach more than 1 million COVID-19 cases. And while the numbers are climbing throughout the state, nowhere has been hit quite as hard as El Paso, which is averaging more than 1,000 new cases per day. So many people are sick, the city's convention center has been converted into a field hospital. Mallory Falk from member station KERA has more.
Funeral home manager Jorge Ortiz wheels a body to his chapel, but not for a funeral service. The chapel's been converted into a storage cooler. Ortiz runs Purchase Funeral Homes. So many bodies have come in, he had to create extra space.
The last 2 weeks, we have received more COVID cases than the past, I would say, months. I mean, when we hit the peak back in maybe the summer, that's not nothing compared to what we're living right now.
His team is trying to manage this constant flow and comfort so many families who've lost loved ones to the virus.
They just took them to emergency. They left them there, and next time they saw them was 2 weeks later when they passed away. They saw them in a coffin. They saw them in the funeral home.
More than 700 El Pasoans have officially died due to COVID complications, though the number is likely much higher, with hundreds of deaths still under investigation. County officials brought in 4 mobile morgues, but that wasn't enough. They added 6 more. As coronavirus numbers climb, state and local leaders have fought over how to respond. El Paso's top county official ordered a temporary shutdown of non-essential businesses. The state attorney general challenged that order, calling it unnecessary and illegal. A court then blocked the order and a countywide curfew. And El Paso's mayor has encouraged businesses to stay open. While leaders clash, some healthcare workers are still calling for a shutdown.
Claro que también pensamos en los negocios.
Nurse Ariana Lucio spoke at a bilingual press conference on Friday.
Pero, ¿qué negocio va a haber si no hay gente, si todos estamos muriéndonos?
Of course, we also think about businesses, she said. But what business will there be if there's no people, if we're all dying? Hospitals are stretched thin. Dozens of ICU patients have been airlifted to other cities in Texas. The state and federal governments sent in extra healthcare workers and more medical supplies.
So within El Paso, we've probably created almost 600 new beds.
Joel Hendricks is chief medical officer at University Medical Center, one of the region's largest. He estimates more than 60% of patients at his hospital are there because of COVID. For now, they've been able to expand, like setting up medical tents in a parking lot, because of the resources the state sent to El Paso. But he's worried what happens when other communities see a spike in infections.
And that's why we think it's very important for El Paso to start blunting this curve and decreasing the amount of infections that are being transmitted. If we can do that, then they won't end up in our hospital because they won't need that care. So yes, we are concerned, and certainly we haven't even gotten to flu season yet, which will affect all the nation, and in particular Texas, where most of our resources are coming from.
Some state resources are now going to Lubbock, just the latest hotspot in Texas. For NPR News, I'm Mallory Falk in El Paso.
Let's turn our attention back to vaccines. Here's a recorded report from NPR. The story is, in rural areas, residents may be reluctant to take a COVID-19 vaccine.
Whenever a COVID-19 vaccine is approved, tens of millions of doses will have to be delivered around the country. But surveys show that, in addition to any distribution challenges, millions of Americans just don't trust a vaccine and say they may not take it. Dr. Lindsay Paulson is a family medicine physician in Ray, Colorado, with a population of just over 2,300, and she joins us now. Dr. Paulson, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for inviting me.
Let me ask you first, how do you stand with COVID-19 in Ray?
We're starting to see a slow trickle of COVID-19 cases. We're up to just around 250 cases total in the county since the beginning of the pandemic.
If and when there's a vaccine, do you have any concerns about it reaching Ray, Colorado, or being kept cold or anything like that?
I think that the distribution is most likely going to be effective. I don't envision the actual delivery of vaccine being the rate-limiting step in vaccinating our population here.
What is the limiting step? Do you know people in your community who say, I just don't want a vaccine?
I think that before we're going to be able to convince our community to take a vaccine, we're going to have to convince the community that COVID is a true public health concern in a population where most people think that COVID is nothing more than a cold or a mild flu. We may have difficulty convincing folks that they need a vaccine for this illness.
So let me try to understand that. The skepticism comes from the fact that although people in the community have come down with COVID, most of the cases haven't been very serious. Please explain what you can to us.
I think there's a variety of different causes for skepticism. I think that we have a population that is known for being fiercely independent. A lot of the farmers and ranchers here in northeastern Colorado and really all of rural America are skeptical. And I also think there's some skepticism related to many of the conspiracy theories that we've seen circulating. Some folks mentioned concern over Bill Gates trying to microchip us with the vaccine. And so I think that we're going to have to tackle a number of the conspiracy theories, and we're going to have to convince people that they really will benefit, not only individually, but also as a population from receiving a vaccine.
Dr. Paulson, what can you do about that? I mean, you can have a conversation with someone who comes into your office, but I imagine most of the people living in a town of 2,300 aren't going to necessarily have an appointment over the next few weeks or months, right?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, we're a close-knit community, so I think it's really going to boil down a little bit possibly to peer pressure. But the strategy that we've kind of employed from the beginning of the pandemic, but as it relates to any public health measure, including flu vaccine seasonally, is the idea that if the medical community in our town accepts the vaccines as safe and effective, we're willing to vaccinate our families. I think there may be some community buy-in, but I think it's going to be just a widespread educational campaign. I think we're going to have to plan to utilize social media, but also our local newspaper, and then just word of mouth. I think that we've done a good job so far of utilizing our medical staff to spread the word.
I've been told that Ray is a close-knit community. You've even said that. Does that help at a time like this when we talk about so much of the country being divided? Is that sensation unknown in Ray, or do you have your divisions there too?
Well, I think that that's an interesting question because in general, we all are pretty united. We all take care of each other. I do think there's been quite a bit of division as it relates to the pandemic. And then also, you know, the election, of course, is going to cause some division. So there's a number of factors that I think have contributed to a little bit more division in our community than is typical. But really, at the end of the day, people are still helpful to each other. We still care about each other. I think we're able to gather less frequently. The churches are meeting less. There's fewer sporting events. And so people just aren't able to see their neighbors and look them in the eye. And that makes it easy to forget how much we care about each other. And I think that goes for all of us nationwide. It's easy to forget everyone's humanity, really.
Dr. Lindsay Paulson is a family medical physician in Ray, Colorado. Thanks so much for being with us, Doctor.
Thanks again.
Now, staying with the rural communities, here's an article from USA Today that was published Sunday. Our neighbors, our family members. Small town hospitals overwhelmed by COVID-19 deaths. By Ken Altucker, USA Today. In North Texas, Moore County Hospital District CEO Jeff Turner is managing more than his small rural hospital can handle. The Dumas Hotel has space and staff for 11 coronavirus patients, but only three who are really sick and need intensive care. When they need life-saving therapies Turner's hospital can't provide, his staff tries to find open beds at larger hospitals in Amarillo, about 50 miles to the south. When those hospitals are full, his staff scours for space, first in Midland, Wichita Falls, and Lubbock, then in Dallas, Denver, Albuquerque, Oklahoma City, even Kansas City, Missouri, more than 500 miles away. Some patients have died waiting for space at big city hospitals. Six patients died in 6 days recently. Two died within 24 hours last week. In a small town, these are our neighbors, our family members, Turner said. That makes it tough. Last spring, the coronavirus attacked major metro areas like New York City and Houston. This summer, it spread to suburban communities and ravaged the Sun Belt. The current wave, which has surpassed 2,000 deaths a day, frightens public health officials because it's steering into the frayed healthcare safety net of rural America. Small hospitals, understaffed and financially vulnerable before the pandemic, are under siege as the virus runs unchecked from North Dakota to the Texas Panhandle. Many of these hospitals are in towns where people are more likely to eschew precautions such as masks and social distancing at churches, grocery stores, and other public places. Many of the nation's nearly 1,800 rural hospitals lack the equipment, workforce, and expertise to handle a surge of COVID-19 patients. Nurses and doctors are getting sick, leaving already short-staffed hospitals more desperate for workers. These rural hospitals are designed for primary care, general surgery, said Alan Morgan, CEO of the National Rural Health Association. They were never designed for a global pandemic response. Begging them to take a patient. At West River Health Services in Hettinger, North Dakota, CEO Matthew Shallon knows the state's dire situation. North Dakota's 108 deaths in the first week of November is a record. The percentage of positive COVID-19 tests in the state during the week ending November 14th was 2, according to Johns Hopkins University. That's true from North Dakota to Oklahoma, a region with the highest per capita infection rates in the nation. Cases, hospitalizations, and deaths are on the rise. Most people who test positive at clinics can go home, quarantine, and monitor their symptoms. But those whose symptoms worsen get incredibly sick and need to be hospitalized, Shayen said. Some of them are admitted to West River's COVID wing, which has space for 4 patients. Others must be sent to larger hospitals in Bismarck or Fargo or neighboring South Dakota, Minnesota, or Montana. Before COVID-19, I don't think I ever made a call to another hospital administrator, begging them to take a patient, Shane said. Lately, his staff has had to call 7 or 8 hospitals to find a bed for critically ill patients. It's not that hospitals don't want to help. Larger metro hospitals often lack ICU beds and healthcare workers to take on more COVID-19 patients. Another task Cheyenne couldn't have imagined just a few months ago, West River has rewritten end-of-life visitation rules so family and friends can visit dying loved ones. Visitors must sign a liability waiver and wear personal protective equipment. Those visitors risk contracting COVID-19, but nurses argued that patients deserve to be with their families in their last days. We want to provide that last little comfort of a family member when someone is at end of life, Shayen said. Beyond caring for patients, Shayen worries about how to keep nurses and doctors safe. An emergency order signed by North Dakota's health officer last week allows health workers who test positive for the coronavirus but show no symptoms to keep working in COVID-19 units. Cheyenne said his health system rejected the idea. He doesn't want to risk spreading the virus to healthy nurses or other clinicians, which could shut down the hospital's emergency room. Hospital administrators are already planning for the winter when heavy snowfall closes roads and prevents air travel. Extreme weather could halt patient transfers and make it difficult to bring in traveling nurses or state-provided health workers. If that happens, the healthcare system will shut down clinics and assemble all hands on deck at the hospital, Cheyenne said. We need to be careful because we don't have a big stable of workers available on standby, he said. Expertise and equipment lacking. Most of the nation's rural hospitals are called critical access hospitals, and they're licensed for up to 25 beds. Each has an average of one or two ventilators, and most don't have ICU beds, said Morgan of the National Rural Health Association. It's especially difficult to manage on an emerging threat like COVID-19 as doctors around the world learn how to treat it and protocols shift. Large hospitals have teams of specialists, such as infectious disease doctors, respiratory specialists, and critical care doctors. Rural hospitals usually don't. And they may not have access to cutting-edge therapies and treatments that have helped COVID-19 patients recover at academic medical centers and suburban community hospitals. These are often family doctors taking care of those patients, said Dr. William Schaffner, a Vanderbilt University School of Medicine professor of preventative medicine and an infectious disease specialist. They frequently can't transfer their patients to the major medical center because the major medical center is all jammed up. Rural hospitals long have sought to address shortages of doctors, nurses, and other healthcare workers. These hospitals struggle financially. 17 rural hospitals have closed in 2020 and 136 over the past decade, according to the National Rural Health Association. During the pandemic, hospitals' finances took a hit after they cut off non-emergency operations to make room for COVID-19 patients. Communities resist wearing masks. It's also challenging because these hospitals are in communities that have been more likely to eschew masks and social distancing. In Tennessee, a state health worker visited rural communities to discuss how the coronavirus vaccine will be distributed when it's available, expected early next year. Most residents didn't wear masks at the indoor meetings, Schaffner said. The more rural you get, the more disdainful people are, the more doubting and skeptical they are about the whole COVID story, Schaffner said. Mask wearing has been inconsistent nationwide. President Donald Trump rarely wears a mask in public and has ridiculed his rival Joe Biden for being so diligent. The surge in cases after the election might be an opportunity for Democrats and Republicans alike to stress the importance of wearing masks, Schaffner said. We have to give everyone an off-ramp, he said. It's not that they were wrong in the past. It's that circumstances have changed. They're now much more dire. For the first time last week, the Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention said masks protect the person wearing it. Prior guidance said they protected others from the masked person. Experts warn the nation is embarking on the most difficult phase of the pandemic. Holiday celebrations over the summer spurred large gatherings across the country that were blamed for the summer spike. Gatherings at Thanksgiving could fuel even more spread, especially as it gets colder and people spend more time indoors. The situation in the next 2 to 4 weeks is going to be grim, said Andrew Pavia, chief of pediatric infectious diseases at the University of Utah School of Medicine. If Thanksgiving does to us the same things that Memorial Day and Labor Day did, and people gather as we all want to do without taking precautions, we can see another acceleration going into Christmas. Momentum is growing in several parts of the country for tighter restrictions on gatherings and masks. Republican governors in Iowa, Ohio, and Utah have issued new mask mandates. The city of Fargo, North Dakota, has ordered that masks be worn in public. But the city council in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, rejected a mask ordinance last week. Cheyenne said people wore masks in North Dakota in the early days of the pandemic when lockdowns were in place. As restrictions loosened, the state didn't see an immediate jump in cases, and residents just got fatigued. He said he has seen more people wearing masks in recent weeks, particularly friends and family of those who've gotten sick. It's going to take a lot of communication from everyone at all levels of the state to get this done. In Dumas, Texas, few people wore masks during the summer, Turner said. Kids are attending schools and few have gotten sick, but that might be because we're not testing the kids. Cases in surrounding Moore County continue to climb, with about 7% of residents testing positive, according to figures from the Texas Department of State Health Services. The World Health Organization recommends testing enough people that the positive rate is 5% or lower. If it's higher, it could mean a region is missing cases. Turner has noticed more masks around town, too. The mother of one of his employees became ill. So did a neighbor's family member and local police officers. It's people you know, Turner said. It gets up close and personal in a small town. That article mentioned the fatigue as the pandemic has wore on. This is from NPR. U.S. Surgeon General blames pandemic fatigue for recent COVID-19 surge.
This is difficult news, but we feel it's necessary. We're going to start with a coronavirus pandemic because by nearly every metric, the crisis is getting worse. Yesterday, the U.S. recorded more than 184,000 new coronavirus cases, and the number of daily cases has topped more than 100,000 for the last few days, something we haven't seen before. The nation's hospitals are feeling it. Across the country, the number of hospitalizations has nearly doubled in just the last 2 weeks, and there are now more people being treated for COVID-19 in hospitals than at any other time during the pandemic. This, of course, is on top of the more than 240,000 Americans who have died from COVID-19, the most of any nation. So as the winter months approach and people are more likely to be spending time indoors, not to mention the beginning of preparations for the winter holidays, is there any way to keep things from getting worse? We've called Dr. Jerome Adams to talk about this. He's the Surgeon General of the United States, the nation's doctor, as it were, and a member of the White House Coronavirus Task Force. Prior to that, he served as Indiana State Health Commissioner. Dr. Adams, welcome. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I wish it was under different circumstances, but the good news is that we are almost to the end of this.
What is your take, though, on why it's gotten this bad? I mean, particularly because we know more about the virus now than we did in the early days, and for months, public health experts like yourself have anticipated that this flu season might be especially bad. So one would think that we've had some time to prepare. Why has it gotten this bad?
Well, it really is as simple as just pandemic fatigue. The virus hit different places of the country at different points. And so you've had people who've been doing these things since February, March, April, but they didn't really start to see the wave until later on, and they're just plain tired.
Well, you know, earlier this week, the White House Coronavirus Task Force, of which you remember, as we said, warned states that there is a, quote, continued accelerating community spread across the top half of the country where temperatures have cooled and Americans have moved indoors, end quote. Is the task force doing something right now to try to stem this, other than giving the guidance that you have been giving all along?
Well, we really have a strategy of going out to these locations and talking to people face-to-face on the ground, because people in North Dakota or people in Arkansas or people in California may not feel that they have to take the same measures as someone in New York City. So I've been in South Dakota, I've been in Wisconsin, I've been in Ohio just over the past 2 weeks, really speaking directly to people, helping them understand their surges that are going on and the measures that they need to take at their state level.
Yesterday, our colleague Elsa Chang spoke with Dr. Atul Gawande. He is a member of President-elect Biden's COVID-19 advisory group, and he says the Trump administration has not been cooperating and sharing key information about the pandemic response. How do you respond to that?
There's none of us on this side and I hate that you even have to put it that way, who want anything more than to get this virus under control. And we have always been willing to work with anyone to get it done. So I hope we can really move past this whole Biden task force, Trump task force, and talk about what we need to do for the nation.
Forgive me, Dr. Adams, that would only be necessary if the people who are currently in positions of government authority would do what has traditionally been done during periods of transition, which is make office space available, communicate open lines of communication. That has traditionally been the responsibility of the party in power. So it would seem to be, so the question is really, it's a yes or no question. Is the White House task force sharing information with the people who have been advising President-elect Biden?
Well, and what I would say to that is, yes, we are sharing information with everyone. There is no information that we have that we don't share with the American public in general, and that is not available to the Biden task force. And so I'm here, and I'm willing to talk to anybody at any point. And that's the most honest answer that I can give you, because I think we all need to have the information to make informed decisions to protect ourselves.
Thanksgiving is fast approaching.
Yes.
People want to gather. What should they do?
The safest way to celebrate Thanksgiving this year is to celebrate with people in your household. Period. Point blank. End of story.
Which is kind of a bummer.
It is, but this year, the way you show your family that you love them, the way you show your friends you love them, is to prevent them from your potential asymptomatic spread. And one of the things you can do is to quarantine ahead of the holiday if you are planning to be around other people. Consider lower risk activities such as a small dinner or virtual. The three W's are most important. If you do come together around other people, wear a mask, wash your hands, and frequently disinfect commonly touched surfaces, and watch your distance from other people. And if you can't do these things in this environment where you're planning on coming together, then you should probably stay home, because again, this virus is incredibly unforgiving.
And as we mentioned, this is flu season. Are there some things that people could keep in mind to distinguish between the common flu or typical flu symptoms and the coronavirus? Is there something that people should be thinking about as we enter what is generally peak flu season from now through February?
COVID seems to spread much more easily than the flu, and it causes much more serious illnesses in some people. So again, take measures to prevent both. Wearing a mask, washing your hands, and watching your distance. Get your flu shot this year. The one symptom that I would alert people to that really differentiates flu from COVID is loss of taste or smell. If you get that symptom, then you need to be reaching out to your health provider right away and going in and getting a COVID test. But if you have any symptoms that are suspicious for cold or flu, contact your health provider, and they will help you think through what the process is for differentiating between cold and flu. Do not try to self-diagnose.
That was Dr. Jerome Adams. He is the nation's doctor, the Surgeon General of the United States, and a member of the White House Coronavirus Task Force. Dr. Adams, thank you so much for your time and sharing your expertise with us, and we'll certainly keep a good thought for you and for the country.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. And again, just hang in there. We'll get through this together.
And now we have a pair of reports from NPR focused on the upcoming weeks. The first is the do's and don'ts of winter gathering during the pandemic. And following is, as COVID-19 cases surpass records, cautions against holiday gatherings.
Cold weather has set in around much of the country, and with coronavirus cases surging, people are trying to figure out ways to spend time together safely. Ben Johns, general merchandising manager at REI, said he started seeing items for colder weather beginning to sell this summer.
Really, the thing that blew us away was starting in August, we saw snow product starting to sell, specifically snowshoes and cross-country skis, but then also things that go along with that. So insulated boots, base layers to keep folks warm.
We're going to talk through now the do's and don'ts of COVID in winter with Julie Marcus. She's an epidemiologist and associate professor at Harvard Medical School. Hello.
Thanks for having me.
What concerns you the most as the temperatures begin to drop, especially as the holidays are approaching?
Well, I think some of the surge that we're seeing now probably is due to people gathering indoors more in areas of the country where it's now getting more uncomfortable to be outside. So I am concerned that we are going to continue to see more transmission happening indoors. And I think at that point, the best we can do is, you know, of course, stay with our household as much as possible, but that, you know, that's not going to be sustainable throughout the winter for everyone. And so I think trying to stay with a social bubble throughout the winter, I think will probably reduce risk.
I'd just like to get your take on this moment. We are just seeing these record cases, and a lot of people are asking themselves, with the pandemic so out of control in the United States, can it even be dialed back by something that I do?
Well, we don't want to have a sense of futility here. Every person, of course, can try to reduce their risk and the risk to others around them. But we also need to keep pushing for federal support. In many ways, we've been kind of left to our own devices here, and there are still policies that have not been put in place, like paid sick leave, you know, safe spaces for people to isolate outside of crowded households. Those are things that should have been in place on day one and are still, you know, not widespread across the U.S. and certainly not supported at a federal level.
Let's talk about the holidays. They are fast approaching. A lot of families are planning to gather in person. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I want to be clear that every day that goes by, the risk of gathering with people outside of one's household and traveling to see loved ones is getting higher. But I think we cannot just say don't gather and leave it at that, because some people will, and some people really need to travel and need to see their loved ones. You know, maybe somebody is at toward the end of their life. I think we have to give people tools to mitigate risk in those situations. You know, outdoors is safer than indoors. Keep your gatherings small. Try to be creative. You know, we don't necessarily have to have Thanksgiving that looks like it always does. But I think it would be a mistake to just say, you know, you absolutely cannot travel, because we know people will. And that kind of goes back to abstinence only messaging, where we know when we just say, you know, just say no to sex or to drug use, that what happens is people eventually do have sex or use drugs, and they lack the tools they need to protect themselves.
What are your plans for the winter?
My plans are to stick with my household as much as possible. You know, we're going to try to layer up and be outdoors as much as possible. But I could see at some point creating a bubble, let's say, with one other family.
Julia Marcus is an epidemiologist and associate professor at Harvard Medical School. Thank you very much.
Great to be here. Thank you.
1 week ago today, the United States reached a terrible number, 10 million COVID cases since the start of the pandemic. This morning, we reach 11 million, 1 million new cases in 1 week, which shows how quickly the situation is deteriorating. Hospitalizations are reaching a record high, and that helps explain why public health officials are urging people to rethink their holiday plans. NPR's Allison Aubrey is on the line, as she is just about every Monday. Hey there, Allison.
Good morning, Steve.
You know, I was looking at the NPR chart of the states that we published the other day, yellow, orange, or red, depending on how bad it is, and just a shocking amount of the map was red. I mean, most of it seemed to be.
Yeah. You know, it's hard to point to hotspots because the virus is circulating so widely all over the country. Since early November, Steve, there's been an 80% increase in new cases, and we have not yet reached the peak. I mean, just look at the positivity rates. I just checked CDC's latest numbers. They're rising nationwide. We have a double-digit 11% positivity rate. Some counties in Iowa, the upper Midwest, have two times that rate. And there are 70,000 people hospitalized with COVID-19 right now.
And I guess we should mention these things happen in a sequence. They're kind of lagging indicators. If we have a ridiculous increase in positivity now, that means a ridiculous increase in hospitalization in a few weeks and an increase in deaths a few weeks after that.
That's right. And right now we're averaging about 1,000 deaths a day. That's 42 people every hour, Steve, dying of COVID-19. And that number's been rising. You know, when you hear about exponential growth of the virus, that means every infected person is spreading it to at least one more person. So two cases become four, then 16, then 32. Very quickly, state, that's what has happened. It spirals out of control. I spoke to Mark Boom. He's a doctor. He's the CEO of Houston Methodist. He says right now there are about 150 people every day being admitted to Texas Medical Center hospitals. And he said if the current trend continues, it is just not sustainable.
So 2 weeks from now, that's 300. And then 2 weeks after that, that's 600. And 2 weeks after that, that's 1,200 if that trend continues. And that's what we cannot allow to happen. And it just, things get so much worse so quickly. We've got to be vigilant and we've just got to persevere.
He says it's just absolutely crucial that everyone take precautions to slow the spread.
You know, I'm remembering in the spring when people talked about flattening the curve, meaning if you traced the infections on a chart, there was this big curve heading upward. You needed to bend it back down again. But when I look at the chart now, there's no curve. It's vertical.
Yeah.
It's going straight up. What do we do?
You know, take, for example, what they've done in England. They've basically gone back to a nationwide lockdown. They've kept schools open, but restaurants, pubs, lots of non-essential businesses have been closed. Here in the U.S., Steve, it's a hodgepodge. I mean, Chicago has a stay-at-home advisory. There are new rules for gatherings in Michigan. North Dakota just issued a mask mandate. I spoke to one of President-elect Biden's coronavirus advisors, Lois Pace. She told me at their very first meeting last week, the focus was to lay the groundwork for a much more unified approach. And what we're likely to see here, Steve, is a set of evidence-based guidelines on when to issue restrictions and when to loosen them.
You know, these things are a dial, not a light switch. And so I think that that will be a part of our discussion is really understanding better when and where to turn up that dial based on data.
She says this is just crucial going forward.
I just want to observe, Allison, I've now heard two different Biden advisors state a consistent message, that phrase about the restrictions being a dial, not a light switch. You have an idea of an incoming team that has an idea about how they want to talk to the country. But, of course, there's also an outgoing administration. The main message from that administration over the weekend, Dr. Anthony Fauci said that President Trump hasn't met the coronavirus task force in months. The president is busy making false claims about the election. So what is the safest approach for the holidays for people?
You know, I think there's a new element of pandemic fatigue here, Steve. Most people get it. This is not the year for big parties, for big gatherings. But many people are expanding their social bubbles ever so slightly, getting together with one or two more friends, allowing one more play date. It's this incremental expansion of our social bubbles combined with more time indoors that some experts say is leading to more spread of the virus in households. I spoke to Dr. David Rubin about what this means for the holiday. He's the director of policy lab at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia.
The safest thing to do is to keep your bubble extremely small and not to gather with extended relatives. But if other families are like mine and I'm in the middle of this, I'm still sort of debating with my own siblings.
So you hear it right there. It's tough for him. He says if you are planning to host a gathering, you can ask every person who will join you to quarantine beginning today, beginning right now. Every day they limit their interactions with others, it will decrease the likelihood they're coming to your house infected.
I'm hearing stories of people asking their relatives to get tested before the gathering.
Yeah, you know, a test cannot hurt, but Ruben says it's only so helpful.
The drive-by test on Tuesday before Thanksgiving is not going to protect the family at the Thanksgiving table because it only tells you about your exposure 6 or 7 days ago, particularly if you've not been quarantined.
You know, in the interim, you may have been exposed. That's why if you want to protect the people you're gathering with, everyone's got to take precautions.
Can I ask about additional findings about what happens to people who do test positive and who do have the worst symptoms? There's some research about people diagnosed with mental health disorders, including anxiety and depression and insomnia. What's going on?
That's right. A very large new study based on the medical records of more than 60,000 people diagnosed with COVID here in the U.S. found 1 in 5 were also diagnosed with conditions including anxiety, depression, insomnia, as you say, within the first 3 months following the infection. I spoke to Adam Kaplan about this. He's a psychiatrist at Johns Hopkins. They now have a clinic for COVID patients who have survived hospitalization and need follow-up care. He says he is not surprised by these findings.
We know that when you get COVID-19, it has this effect on the entire body, including the fact it does affect the brain. And so just any inflammation in the body will register through the brain. That inflammation affects people's moods. And in fact, this is one of the awful longer-term consequences of the infection for many people.
And complicating this, Steve, is the fact that isolation is a risk factor for anxiety and depression. And what are we all being asked to do to slow the spread? Limit contact with others. So it's tough.
NPR's Allison Aubrey is here to tell us the truth, no matter how grim. Allison, thanks so much.
Thank you, Steve.
Now here's a story from CNN that is certainly related to the pandemic. Thousands of cars form lines to collect food in Texas by Melissa Alonzo and Susanna Cullian. Thousands of people lined up for groceries at a food bank distribution event in Dallas this weekend, with organizers saying the COVID-19 pandemic has increased the need in the city. North Texas Food Bank, NTFB,